Okay, thank you. A good Erev Shabbos to everybody. Thank you very much for joining the Parsha Shir. Rav Soloveitchik's ideas on Parshas Bahaloscha and Shlach, these are world famous. These are among the most famous things Rav Soloveitchik ever wrote, these Parshios. And one of the main themes we're going to highlight right at the beginning of the Shir is the very, very special and unique connection that the Jewish people has with Eretz Yisrael. That's really one of the things that Rav Soloveitchik talks a lot about in the beginning of Parsha Shlach. The whole episode of the Meraglim, Rav Soloveitchik understands, is the Jewish people not at its very beginning of its history, not appreciating and understanding the beauty and the special, unique nature of the relationship between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. Usually when we have this year, we're all talking in a base medrash in a Woodmere. Jerry's sitting now in Eretz Yisrael, so he could vouch. He could vouch for the special connection that we have. But let's begin at the very beginning. Shlach lecha anashim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands Moshe Rabbeinu to send spies. So the very, very first question that Rav Soloveitchik addresses, is, what was the purpose of the whole mission? What was the whole purpose of the mission of sending spies? What do you mean sending spies? You send spies when you're an army that needs to know how to attack. But Klal Yisrael was going through the desert with a cloud of glory. They were going through the desert with a pillar of fire at night and a cloud of glory. They didn't need to know how to attack. They didn't need to send spies. What are you talking about, sending spies? So, I'm going to start with, we'll start with the first piece here. Rashi, there's a famous Rashi, very, very first Rashi, Pasuk Shlach is a very, very famous Rashi. Let's take a look inside the Rashi. Lama nismacha parashas meraglim parashas Miriam, famous Rashi. Why is the story of the meraglim, the spies, next to the parasha of Miriam? Lafisha laksa aliske diba. Miriam got tzara'as because she spoke lashon hara about her brother Moshe. Shedibra b'acha, u'rishayim halalu, these wicked spies, ra'u v'lo lakhu musar. They saw that Miriam spoke lashon hara about Moshe Rabbeinu, and they didn't take musar that they shouldn't have spoken lashon hara about the land of Israel. That's what Rashi says. That's why these two stories are next to each other, because Miriam spoke lashon hara and got punished, and the spy spoke lashon hara about the land of Israel. So they should have seen that you're not supposed to speak badly about others, so they shouldn't have spoken badly about the land of Israel. What a strange comparison. That Miriam spoke lashon hara about Moshe, and so it's written right next to it, the spy spoke lashon hara about this about Israel. So Rav Soloveitchik here has a beautiful idea in terms of what's the connection, what's the deeper lesson that Rashi's trying to teach us over here. Yeah, very nice. Here lashon hara, there lashon hara, everywhere lashon hara. This was lashon hara about a person, this was lashon hara about a land. So the Torah puts it together. Said Rav Soloveitchik, no, Rashi's trying to teach us something much, much, much deeper than this. Not just this was lashon hara, that's lashon hara. Seder of Soloveitchik, what Rashi is trying to teach us here is that the nature of the lashon hara was a similar type of nature. The nature of the avera was a similar type of avera. What do you mean? Miriam and Aaron, Sadiqei Ador, Manhigei Ador, these were holy, holy people. How could they speak lashon hara about Moshe Rabbeinu? What was the nature of the lashon hara? The nature of the lashon hara was they thought that Moshe Rabbeinu was a prophet, just like Miriam was a prophetess and Aaron was a prophet. They were all prophets. So why is Moshe Rabbeinu getting all high and mighty and separating himself from his wife? We're prophets. We talk to God, and God never told us to separate us to stop our family lives. So what's the explanation? They didn't realize the special, unique connection that Moshe Rabbeinu had with Hashem above and beyond a regular prophet. Moshe Rabbeinu was on a different level. He was unique. He was special. He was another level. They thought, okay, he's a regular prophet. He's a regular prophet. That's what they thought. They didn't realize that his level of prophecy was on a whole different level. They didn't see his uniqueness. They didn't see his singularity, where of salvation called. They didn't see the segula relationship that Moshe Rabbeinu had with Hashem. And said Rav Salvechik so beautifully, that's the exact same sin as the sin of the spies. It's the exact same sin as the sin of the spies. What do you want from the spies? What'd you tell them to do? You told them to go check out the land, they checked out the land. You told them to go check out the cities, they checked out the cities. You told them to go check out the people, they checked out, they reported exactly what they saw. What's the Lashon Hara? What's the problem? They did exactly what they were supposed to do. Seder of Soloveitchik, they missed the whole point of the mission. They missed the whole point. The mission, they were supposed to report on the cities, they were supposed to report on the people, they did all that correctly. But what they missed out on is, what was the whole goal of descending? As Rav Salavitch is going to explain in a moment. What was the whole goal? They misunderstood. They missed out on the whole goal. The whole goal was, by looking at the cities and by looking at the people and by looking at the land, you should appreciate the uniqueness and the special Kedusha and the special holiness and the special atmosphere that this land is going to imbue in the Jewish people. It's not just a regular land. This shot of Rav Salavitch always reminds me of something that Rav Nachman Mibreslov once said. Rav Nachman Mibreslov once said, who is the true tzaddik? Who is the true tzaddik? Rav Nachman Mibreslov once said, the true tzaddik is the person who on the outside looks like everybody else, but underneath he's fire. Underneath he's fire. And Rav Nachman Mibreslov said, Eretz Yisrael is a land that looks like every other land, but underneath it's fire. Underneath it's fire. On the outside it has snow, it has rain, it has wind, it has mountains, it has valleys. It looks like every other land. That's what the spies missed. And Rav Salavitch has an incredible mashal to explain this. He takes this idea of the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael very, very far. Listen to what he says in the next piece. V'yasur Eretz Kanan. Why was it necessary to send spies at all? What were they supposed to do? What report did Moshe expect from them? The report they brought was actually the truth. Why were they so severely punished? The Egel Azav, we understand what the sin was. But what was so bad about the spies? Says Rav Salavitch, first he draws the distinction between the word viyasuru and liragel. Liraglel, miraglim, is really to spy for war. Viyasuru is a different thing. It's to tour the land. To tour it. To get a feeling. Like to take a teal. That's what they were supposed to do. So take a teal. The spy's mission was not to spy liragel, but rather losuras arutz. To scout them. The ragel means spying to identify the military weak spots in the defense system. Yosef accuses his brothers of being miraglim. But nothing of that sort was entrusted to these 12 scouts. Their assignment was to search and explore, to scout. It was not military intelligence, but a study mission. They were to see the land, and after their return, they were to submit a number of reports about the people, about the soil, about the land. Moshe needed no military intelligence when the Jews left Egypt, and he needed none here. Moshe knew very well that when they would go into Eretz Yisrael, it would be through the miraculous. There would be miracles. There was no need to send spies. Instead, listen to this. He quotes a Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin. What does it say in the second paragraph of Maseches Kiddushin? Asur lo la'adam sheyikadesh esaisha ad sheyirena. Shema yira badavar megunav tizgana olav rachmana amar v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. A Gemara Kiddushin me'malaf amedalaf. The Gemara says, and I don't know how they deal with this in Hasidic circles, that's why they have a Beshua. I don't know if you have Hasidic relatives, maybe you know what a Beshua is. That's because of this Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara says, it's forbidden to marry a woman until you see her first. Sometimes in the Hasidic circles, you're marrying somebody, you didn't see her. So where do you see her? Where's the first time the chassan sees the wife? at the Vart. That's the first time he sees her. At the Vart, in the Hasidic circles. They call it a Bishua. As in, Bishua Toivu Umutzlachas. Umutzlachas. Bishua. Bishua Toivu Umutzlachas. So, that's by the Hasidim. But the Gemara says it's forbidden to marry a woman until you see her. Why? Why? He says, he quotes a pasuk in the Chumash first. Moshe acted in accordance with the principle that one must not propose to a girl, let alone get married to a girl, a woman who he does not know, no matter how highly the woman is recommended to him. You could have all the edim in the world, all the testimony in the world, all the world's best shadchanim that say, you don't know this girl, she's unbelievable. It's aser la'adam to marry her until you see for yourself. The Chumash says that Eliezer told Yitzchak about Rivka, and Yitzchak brought her to the tent of Sarah. And first he took, and then Vatikach lo li'isha vayehaver. Even though Eliezer, who was his trusted servant, Avram's trusted servant, told Yitzchak all these great things about Rivka, about her wisdom, intelligence, her chesed, Yitzchak did not marry her immediately. Rashi says over there that he brought into Sarah's tent to see if she was worthy of succeeding Sarah. Would she restore the glory and the pristine beauty of Sarah's tent? Yitzchak waited to see if the same cloud would return to the tent, if the yeast in the dough would rise, if the candle would be relit. When Yitzchak saw that all had returned, then and only then he married Rivka. Eliezer was trustworthy, devoted and loyal, but still Yitzchak did not get married to Rivka until he became convinced that she was Sarah's equal. Marriage is not an ordinary transaction. It is not just a civil commitment or a mundane partnership. It is an existential commitment, a covenantal union. Two lonely people join their souls. Two strangers decide to unite their destinies, to share the same fate, to suffer and rejoice together, to travel together and pay the toll of the road jointly. When one takes on such an all-inclusive, all-encompassing commitment, one cannot trust anyone, no matter how loyal and trustworthy the other person might be. Seder of Soloveitchik, similarly, the Jews at this time were ready to march into Eretz Yisrael. The entry into the land of Israel was not just a physical act of crossing the Jordan River. Going into the land of Israel for the first time, Seder of Soloveitchik, was a marriage. It was a marriage of a people to a land. It was a marriage of a people to a land. A union of the rocky hills and the sandy trails with a people returning to its origin. The entry signified the destiny of a people united with the destiny of a land. Therefore, the people could not just enter the land without meeting it first. They knew it was a land of milk and honey, but they had to experience it and get acquainted with it before they became united. That is why, a short time before the planned entry into the promised land, Moshe sent Miraglim, Lasur Esars, to study the land, not to gather intelligence data, which was completely unnecessary. He sent the would-be groom to meet and to see the would-be bride. Wow. So the Miraglim missed the whole point of the journey. They didn't get it. One more point on this topic. One more point. And when it comes to the word of the sin, if you turn, Jerry, to page 103, we'll come back a little bit, but what did the spies say? Efes ki az ha'am. And the Ramban makes a big deal over the fact that the sin was with one word. Everything else that they said, people were tough and the cities were big, all of that was exactly what they were supposed to do. But with one word they sinned, with the word Efes. Nobody asked them to give their opinion on whether it was doable or not. Nobody asked them that. We just asked them to come back and tell us what you saw. Don't give your editorial comments about whether or not you think it's going to be happening or not. Look what he says. Efes ki azam. All the Rishonim and the inquire as to the nature of the sin of the Miraglim. Mostly explicitly, Moshe explicitly asked them to come back and report. And their report conformed to Moshe's instructions. The Ramban has an extensive discussion on this topic, and he suggests that their sin was in one word that they chose to use in the report, Ephes. Without that word, Jewish history would have been entirely different. Without that one word, Ephes, Jewish history would have been entirely different. Moshe did not task the spies with an evaluation of whether it was within Bnei Israel's power to vanquish the land's inhabitants. Moshe did not ask them to make a prognosis about whether the land could be conquered. He asked them only for a description. Kalev's report, was meant to be a direct counter-argument of the prognosis of the other spies. While their description was accurate, their prediction was flawed. The evil report was not the description, but the prognosis. And that's why, continuing in the next piece, Kalev says, Alo na'alev yarashnu osa, ki yachol nuchalo. Because they missed out on the whole idea of what the whole point was. And that's why Yoshua and Kalev later on page 107 over here, later on, Yoshua and Kalev say, Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. The other spies never reported back to Moshe concerning their mission to see what was needed. Well, only Kalev and Yeshua reported that Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. The land is worthy. We should get married to this land to be united in an indissoluble union. We have no other land, for our destiny is linked up with the destiny of this land. So that's point number one. That's point number one. Oh. Let's go on to point number two, another world-famous idea. I've heard this idea in the name of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I heard this idea in the name of Rav Soloveitchik. A beautiful idea on the Pasuk. I'm now back to page 100. On the Pasuk, Vayikra Moshe Hoshea ben Nun Yehoshua. Moshe called Hoshea ben Nun Yehoshua. And Rashi quotes from Chazal. Rashi says, why did he add a Yud to Yeshua's name? Ka Yoshiacha me'atzas miraglim, right? That the Yud, this Yud, he davened for Yeshua that Hashem should save you and help you have the strength to argue on the miraglim, to not listen to the spies. So Rav Soloveitchik has an amazing pshat on this, based on a medrash. The medrash in Bereishis Rabbah says, where did Hashem get the Yud for Yeshua's name? He took it from Sarai. When he changed Sarai's name to Sarah, so the Yud complained, I used to be part of Sarai, now you're taking me away from Sarai's name and changing it to Sarah. So Hashem said, don't worry, I'm going to take you, Yud, I'm going to add you to Yeshua. Sounds like children's games. Sounds like fairy tales here. The Yud complained. We know, gentlemen, that Midrashim are not fairy tales. Midrashim are not fairy tales. So, Seder of Soloveitchik, what's meant by this Midrash that Hashem took the Yud from Sarai's name and gave it to Yeshua? Listen to this unbelievable pshat. Unbelievable pshat in this Midrash. You're never going to hear a better pshat in this Midrash than this. Never. He said, what's the difference between Sarai and Sarah? Sarai is the personal possessive. Like, in Hebrew, you say, this is Sifri, my Sefer, a Sefer Sheli, Sifri. Sarai means my princess, my private princess. Sarah, when Avram's name was changed from Avram to Avhamon Goyim, Sarai became Sarah. She became not only a private princess in her own home, but Sarah, she became just like Avram was Avhamon Goyim, so Sarah became Sarah over many nations. So Sarai indicates the personal strength, and Sarah indicates a national, global, a public leader. So what did Hashem daven to Yeshua? Yeshua, you should have the private, personal inreach and strength not to follow the crowd. You shouldn't follow the 10 spies. That's why he gave him the Yud from Sarai. Because the Yud from Sarai is that personal, private, strength, inner strength to be who you are in your own home, to be strong. That's what God gave Yeshua, to be personal, private. Stand up for your own values against what the world is saying. Sometimes you have to stand up for what's right. Even the whole world is saying against you. The 10 spies are saying a bad report. Kol Yoshiacha Me'atzes Meraglim, the Yud, should save you. That private Yud, you should have the strength to go against the crowd. What a pshat. Unbelievable. I remember like 20, 25 years ago, my brother saying this over at one of his kids, Brisson. But it's a beautiful pshat. Moshe added the letter Yud so Yeshua would attain the sense of separation and withdrawal that was taken from Sarah. The 10 spies were called an Eda. That's where we learn a minion from the 10 spies. Represents the collective strength of Israel. Moshe changed Yeshua's name so that he would have the strength to separate himself from this collective entity, enabling him to take a principled stand against the prevailing sentiment. Wow. Sometimes you got to have your own personal conviction and strength even to go against the crowd if the crowd is saying the wrong thing. This was what Moshe Rabbeinu davened for Yeshua, Ka Yoshiacha Me'atzes Meraglim. Beautiful. Let's continue. Along the lines of what we said before, I meant to include this earlier, that they didn't even go to Chevron. How can you go to Israel and not go to Chevron? Vayalu vayasu asartim baritzin ad ruch alas, vayal benegu vayovo ad Chevron. Rav Salavita, they came to Chevron, 11 of them didn't even go, and only Kalev went into Chevron. They wouldn't go in. They were too scared, probably, to go to Chevron, the 11 of them. Only Kalev went in. That's the point. There was no revelation of the land's exalted grandeur and glory. They just explored it in a piecemeal fashion. They didn't understand the segula charisma of the land and of the people. Oh, okay. Now, Yoshua and Kalev say, actually it's Kalev. Vayas Kalev is Amel Moshe Vayomer. Alo na'aleh. We're going to make aliyah. Alo na'aleh v'yarashnu osok yochol nuchalo. Rav Salvechik has a beautiful idea on this. Alona alev yarashnu asak yochel nuchala. Chazal say in Maseches Brachos and Daf Hey Amud Aleph, Hashem gave the Jewish people three gifts, and all three of them they only acquired with great toil, difficulty, sweat, and pain and affliction. Yisurim, Gimel Matanos, three gifts Hashem gave the Jewish people. V'chulon lo niknu ela biyisurin. They were all acquired with pain. Torah, Eretz Yisrael, and Olam Haba. Hashem rewards a person in accordance with his effort. A person appreciates something in proportion to the level of hardship he had to undergo to achieve it. To create the eternal bond between spiritual values and the Jew, a Jew had to work for it. A Jew has to experience pain. Listen to what Rav Salvechik says over here. Maybe this is a message that we don't really want to hear. It was a little bit jarring for me to hear it, honestly, myself. Said Rav Salvechik, holiness has one source, sacrifice. Holiness and sacrifice, both literally and figuratively, are fundamentally the same concept. Holiness can only be created through self-sacrifice, pain, effort, and exertion. If a person does not anticipate and struggle, holiness cannot come into being. Right? Holiness means that on Shabbos we take a step back from the world. There's certain things we don't do. We can't do this, we can't do that. That's holiness. Marriage is called kiddushin. Kiddushin, holiness. You can't marry whoever you want. You can't marry your mother, your sister, your uncle, your aunt, you know, somebody else's wife. You can't. It's kiddusha. You have to take a step back. You have to sacrifice a little bit. That the existence of the state of Israel is a miracle is beyond doubt. I'm reading now for you from the writing of Sarah Salvation. At the same time, it is a miracle that came at great cost. At Israel's very inception, on the first night of the state of Israel's existence, bombs were dropped on Tel Aviv. Subsequently, in the years since it has come into being, the relationship of world Jewry to the state of Israel has been like the relationship of a mother to her only child, saturated with trembling, fear, and insecurity. Insecurity because one is never sure if a passenger bus will be attacked. One is never certain if a small fishing vessel in the Gulf of Aqaba will not be fired upon. Again, he's writing this in the 60s, let's remember. A mother whose son is stationed only a few miles from her home is never sure if he will not become the next victim of Arab snipers. Why is the suffering that has accompanied the entire history of the State of Israel necessary? Because the State of Israel involves holiness, and holiness only exists if man, through sacrifice, becomes a partner with Hashem. The paradigm of this partnership is the mitzvah of Bris Milah, to which the Navi says, B'domayich chayi, B'domayich chayi, through your blood you will live. The blood and the suffering allow us to merit the continued existence of Medinat Yisrael. We experience this uncertain period in our history because our very insecurity is a sign that Hashem indeed desires the state of Israel. If Hashem didn't want us to be in Israel, the birth and the subsequent building of the state would have proceeded smoothly. Jewish history is on a zigzag trajectory. Avram was repeatedly promised a child and yet had to wait many long years for Yitzchak, ultimately to be commanded to sacrifice him. Moshe had to wait atop a cold mountain for 40 days until God finally gave him the Torah with Israel's forgiveness. The suffering, the worry, the uncertainty is precisely what Hashem desires of us. Wow. What a lesson for the coronavirus era. The waiting, the worry, the uncertainty, the suffering is exactly what Hashem desires of us. Sounds a little bit like a sadomasochistic religion. Rav Soloveitchik says no, that the struggle and the effort, that's part of the Yisurin. The more someone struggles for something, the more someone appreciates it. Let's continue. Oh, there's a beautiful idea over here. Beautiful, beautiful idea. I think we're going to close with this idea. Beautiful, beautiful idea. So many beautiful ideas, like there is every week. I think we're going to close with this. I have a meeting at 9 o'clock, so I have to end maybe a minute or two early. Va'ata yigdal na'koach Hashem, page 108 over here. So, Hashem gets really angry at the report of the spies. And he says you're going to have to travel 40 years in the desert. Be a punishment. So Moshe starts to defend them. On Pasuk Yud Zayin, Perek, right? And Moshe then invokes the Yud Gimel Midos. Va'ata yignan ha'koach Hashem kasher dibarta limar Hashem Hashem erech ha'payim v'chesed nosei avon fesh v'nake lo yinake poked avon avos ha'bonim al shil yishim ha'ribayim. So Rav Soloveitchik is bothered by this formulation. Yigdal na koach Hashem. Hashem, may your strength be increased. Yigdal na koach Hashem. We've read this pasuk a million and a half times. Yigdal na koach Hashem. God, may your strength be increased. How is God's strength increased? God is omnipotent. He has unlimited strength. What does it mean that God's strength should be increased? Listen to Rav Soloveitchik's unbelievable take about this. About the power of the Jewish people to help Hashem forgive us. The power of the Jewish people to do tshuva, to help Hashem want to forgive us. Listen to this. What precisely does this phrase mean? How could Hashem's omnipotent strength be increased? On the pasuk, Vatishkach Bor Chutzavtem, Rashi comments, when Hashem comes to do good for you, you get him angry and you weaken Hashem's ability to do good for you. On one level, Hashem influences, he gives, he forms. He's the ultimate source, he's the ultimate giver. Man is the receiver. Relative to Hashem, man's capabilities are negligible. He is nothing more than a passive participant. Man only has what Hashem gives him. What Hashem doesn't give him, he lacks. Yet, if it was so one-sided, what possible role would there be in this world for Torah and mitzvos? What's the purpose of my free will? I have free will. What is the purpose if Hashem exclusively plays the role of giver and man is the passive receiver? Why did Hashem give man autonomy? Furthermore, Hashem has agreements with the world and with Israel, with the Jewish people. The halacha states that every agreement has obligations by both parties. Everybody gives and everybody receives. If Hashem is only the giver, what is the role of man? Seder of Soloveitchik, the role of man is to provide assistance to the master of the universe. Man must help Hashem to reveal his presence in the world. So when the pasuk says, Yigdal na koach Hashem, when Moshe Rabbeinu says, let Hashem's power be increased, it means, Klal Yisrael, let us do our part, our tshuva, to help Hashem help us. The Shekhinah, the divine presence, resides with us on this earth. We encounter the Shekhinah continually, yet Hashem is not clearly revealed to us. He's hidden from view. He's in a cloud. He's close, but he does not reveal himself. The hand of Hashem is in human events is not revealed. He's hidden. Hashem is in close proximity to man, so close that man can almost touch him, but not everyone can penetrate the cloud to reveal him. The obscuring cloud takes on any number of guises. We've heard of Soloveitchik say this. We're finishing up the year. We've heard this so many times already. For the physicist, the cloud is a mathematical formula. For the biologist, it is a biochemical reaction. For the physiologist, it is an instinct. For the psychologist, it's a drive. For the general, it's the power of his army. The cloud is any manifestation of nature or man that promotes the illusion that the world operates autonomously, concealing the reality that Hashem is responsible for all that occurs on earth. Hashem can decide to disperse the clouds, and occasionally in history, he reveals himself and proclaims, I am Hashem. More often, however, Hashem remains obscure, whose abode is in transcendence. It is the task of man in general, and Klal Yisrael specifically, to disperse the obscuring cloud in all its forms. Hashem is the king. He is held captive. Melech Asur Baruch Hatim. It's a pasuk in Shir Hashirim. Hashem is held captive, as it were. He chooses to remain obscure. Klal Yisrael has been charged with revealing Hashem's presence in this world and publicizing Hashem's name. This was Hashem's message when he directed Avram, Lech Lecha Me'artzcha Mimolartcha Be'savicha El Ha'aretz Asher Erecha. Hashem is in essence telling Avram, your assignment is to make my presence known in the world. You must dissipate the clouds that obscure me from perception. Just as Avram was charged with this task, we too must continue this mission, a charge that has only increased in urgency in our present day. Listen to this last story, he says. I remember my Chabad Malamed, Reb Soloveitchik says this from when he's 10 or 12 years old. I remember my Chabad Malamed's description of Hashem crying and mourning for the Beis HaMikdash during the 9-day mourning period leading up to Tisha B'Av. I asked my Chabad Malam, I don't understand, why does Hashem have to cry? He's omnipotent. With his word, he created the entire world. Certainly, he could rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Tell him to stop crying and rebuild it. As a child, I did not comprehend my Rebbe's answer. Many years later, I understood that Hashem cannot kiviyachol act alone. There is no awakening above without a corresponding awakening below. Hashem is indeed omnipotent. But the task of revealing his presence is the great mission of Klal Yisrael, of his people. So when Moshe Rabbeinu said, Yigdal na koach Hashem, Hashem, may your strength be increased, what he was really saying is, Klal Yisrael, let's do tshuva to allow Hashem, let's reveal Hashem's presence in this world, let's do tshuva to allow Hashem's strength to be increased. We need a helper, kiviyachal, to help the Rebbeinu Shalom. Not that he needs our help, but our whole purpose in this world is to reveal Hashem's presence in this world and to allow him, in quotes, to do all the great things for us that he has promised us. And one last point, there's one last beautiful point over here. He has a whole thing about why they mourned after sin. The Torah says they were in mourning after they sinned because they lost their purity. But one last point he says over here by Chala. I love this last point. I'm gonna close with this. So what's the first chapter in the Torah right after the sin of the Meraglim? So first you have the wine pourings, and then you have the parsha of Chala, to be mafresh Chala. It's the first thing. He discusses why the wine pourings are there, but I decided to skip that point. Now, it talks about Chala. Listen to what he says about it. He has a beautiful Vard on Chala, which is a big chizuk. I'm on page 117 in this book over here. Reishis arisoseichem Chala tarimu truma. Although the Torah obligation of separating Chala applies only in the land of Israel, right? We are mafresh Chala even chutz la'aretz, but that's only midrabbanan. And Eretz Yisrael being mafresh Chala is doraisa, and chutz la'aretz means midrabbanan. There is a fundamental difference between this mitzvah and others which are dependent on the land of Israel. Truma and Maaser is a direct result of Kedushas Haaretz, the sanctity of the land of Israel, and is effective on fruits that are still connected to the tree. Truma and Maaser applies even to fruits that are still connected to the tree, and therefore to the land. The obligation of Chala, on the other hand, takes effect well after the harvesting of the wheat. It takes place only once the dough is being prepared, which requires the intervention of man. Thus, this mitzvah reflects Hashem's blessing not only on the land itself, but on man's effort in the land of Israel as well. It is not a coincidence that this mitzvah appears right after the incident of the spies. When they gave their report, the spies emphasized their own feelings of weakness and inadequacy in the face of the obstacles that allegedly stood in their way in an effort to conquer the land. They argued that the fruit of the land was indeed wonderful, but it would be impossible to enjoy those fruits because of the overwhelming strength of the inhabitants and its impenetrable fortifications. The spies' sin was not their report on the land per se, but rather their perceived inability to partake of its fruits. As a counteraction to the spies' argument, Hashem gave us the mitzvah of Chala, which contains within it the power of the land to bestow blessings from above upon its inhabitants. Man's efforts will not be for naught. The land, as well as the efforts of the people, will equally be blessed. So you see what he's saying, that Chala is different than Trumas and Maisus. Chala applies even after you have already plowed and harvested and made it in and ground it into flour and you kneaded it. Now you have a dough. You already put a lot of effort into this, and now you have a mitzvah of Chala. So Chala symbolizes that it's that you have the koichus, you have the ability to sanctify this thing. Now you put a lot of effort into it. This is not the way Hashem made it. Trumas and Maaser already applies once the way Hashem made it, but Chala applies only once you've already invested your energy in it. So you Meraglim say you can't do it. I, Hashem, am showing you in the midst of Chala that your actions are significant. You can do it. You have the power. You have the koichus. You have the ability. I think a lot of times in life, we get frustrated saying, we can't do it. We don't have the koch, we don't have the ability. And the mitzvah of Chala comes to underscore that in fact we do. So Tzitzis here, he talks about blue and white, that blue is the mysterious in life, and white is the, is what's clear to you about Judaism and about Hashem. There's one line here on page 124, I underlined. Only a people sustained by Tchelis could be motivated to reconstitute a state after 2,000 years of exile. We're a crazy people. Okay, there's a lot to talk about. I'm going to stop here. I want to wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. Bez Hashem, next Friday, same bad time, same bad station. I apologize. I have to run to a meeting right now, so I apologize. So everyone should have a great Shabbos. Thank you very much for joining. Barry, great to see your face also. Barry, good to see your face, not just your black thing. Everyone should have a great Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos,
right? Elliot, Dr. Joe, Jay, Mordechai, Jerry. Enjoy Eretz Yisrael there for all the rest of us, Jerry. Enjoy the land there.
I'll breathe the air for everybody.
Breathe the air for all of us. Okay. Hope to get there soon. Take care. Have a good Shabbos.
Shabbos.
Thank you.